This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll visit the homestead of Aaron Gomez to learn about off-the-grid cooking.
This is my version of like, all right, how do I personally create simplicity into where I have enough, but I'm not continually just adding to that cycle? Our way of life is unsustainable.
Also, activist and photographer Renata Campbell talks about photographing inclusive weddings.
When I actually attended the wedding as a photographer and I saw the love between the couple, between the family and the friends for that couple, I was hooked.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, September 20th, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. So far, our farmworker series, Beyond the Furrows, has explored some important issues farmworkers face in their lives and jobs. This week, we'll get more personal. KCBX's Francisco Martinez introduces us to one local farmworker, and we'll learn why she came to the U.S. from Oaxaca, Mexico, and why her dream is to return to her home country someday.
It's been a while, a month and a half actually, since I talked to Francis Salvador in person. The last time we spoke, Salvador was on strike, asking for better pay outside West Coast Berry Farms just north of Guadalupe in San Luis Obispo County. This time, we meet her in her small Santa Maria home, a garage converted into a studio for three: Salvador, her husband, and their three-year-old son, Joshua. When the 23-year-old has time, she takes her son on walks to the park so he can play basketball, which she says is Joshua's favorite activity. Salvador says she loves being a mother, but it's difficult because she needs to focus on work, picking strawberries in the fields, just like her dad. Salvador says she tries to forget about her son at work to focus, but she can't. She says she thinks about how he's being treated, what he's doing, or if he ate. Taking care of her son and working in the fields are tough things to balance, she says. It's a tiring life, but she says she's better off here than in Mexico. She says she had a sad childhood in Mexico because of how poor she was. Salvador says families that do pull themselves up do so outside of her state, looking toward the future. Salvador is from Oaxaca, one of Mexico's poorest states. There are 12 siblings in her family, 2 brothers, 9 other sisters, and her. When she was a kid, Salvador says she played with friends and went to class, but stopped after elementary school because it was too expensive for her family. Salvador started working at 13, but at 16, she left for the United States with one of her brothers, something her parents disapproved of initially. She says her father worked as a strawberry picker and told her about how hard his job was, but that he did it for the family. Salvador wanted to return the favor, so she came to work here. After thinking about the decision to move, she says there was a big need to come to the United States. She says that if she came to the U.S., she could help her parents out a lot. Crossing the border is demanding. You have to pack adequate food and water for the trek, and Salvador says there's no time for stopping. She says if you run out of food or water, in Salvador's case, she ran out of both, it becomes even more difficult. In many cases, she says, that's when the journey ends. But in spite of the difficulties, she and her brother did make it to the United States, settling in Santa Maria where some of their sisters were. Family to Francis Salvador is key in her life: her husband, her son, her siblings, her parents. She knows she wants to be with her family. It's why she wants to go back to Mexico, especially for her son. Salvador says Mexico is everything to her. On top of the country's traditions and culture, she says Mexico is where she was born, raised, and where she spent her youth. But her son, who was born here, might make going back to Mexico a bit more challenging. She's afraid that her son might want to come back to the United States. Salvador says she doesn't want to cross the border again because of how risky it was when she crossed the border the first time. She says she is scared of crossing the border again and doesn't want to return. Salvador says she knows her dreams are meant to be fulfilled in Mexico. She says being here is necessary to save money. But she and her husband want to buy land near their family in Mexico and start a business. She doesn't know the specifics yet, but she says saving up to get to that dream is what makes her work here worthwhile. Salvador says she wants to save as much as she can to go back home and see her parents. She says that is what she wants the most and why she keeps working. Salvador wants her dreams to come true, even if she knows it's a long way there.
No cuesta nada de soñar, ¿verdad? Pero eso es lo
que she says it costs nothing to dream, and it's what they're dreaming about now. She says that's what she's working on and hopes God can help.
Nos ayude, pues.
Life in Mexico, getting to the United States, and working long days as a farm worker. She says she knows all of that is challenging, but it's for an end goal that is bigger than she is. We'll feature another farm worker next week, Reina, who offers her perspective about the weight and impact of being a single mother trying to balance work, family, and giving back to her community. For KCBX News, I'm Francisco Martinez.
This episode of Beyond the Furrows was made possible by a grant from the Sunflower Foundation. On this episode of Playing with Food, Father Ian takes you with him as he explores the homestead of jewelry store owner and former San Luis Obispo City Council member Aaron Gomez to learn about off-the-grid cooking.
I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm Playing with Food. Listen to this.
$99 billion extreme weather cost last year. And it's going to break the record this year. It's going to be well over $100 billion. We know what the driver is, climate change. We know it's causing climate change, human activity. This is no longer subject to debate. And I might add, windmills do not cause cancer. You know, look, we got to get real about what's going on. I really mean it. Think about it.
People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction. And all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you?
If we don't have the guts to take on the fossil fuel industry and tell them that their short-term profits are not more important than the future of this planet, then I got to tell you, according to the scientists, the world that we're going to be leaving our kids and our grandchildren is going to be increasingly unhealthy and uninhabitable. And I think we have a moral responsibility to make sure that does not happen.
That was not scaremongering or hyperbole. That was President Joe Biden, Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg, and U.S. Senator from Vermont Bernie Sanders on the current state of the world's climate. Longer fire seasons here in California, stronger and more frequent hurricanes, longer droughts, bigger floods. A planet that is heating up is a major contributor to that, and we know that the planet is heating up because of human activity. So what can you or I do about it?
Okay, Father Ian, this is Playing with Food. What does Playing with Food have to do with climate change? Please explain.
Well, because we all have to eat, which means we all have to cook. And most cooking methods generate CO2. But former San Luis Obispo City Council member Aaron Gomez has found some low-carbon ways in his Playing with Food.
I'm Aaron Gomez, and what I do, well, there's two parts. I have a jewelry store, so I do that, and then me and my family, meaning my brother and mother, have started this permaculture adventure, which is basically we're starting with kind of soil regeneration to eventually turn into a future farm of sorts, but starting more with the homestead.
Okay, so where are we?
So that's another tricky one. I don't want to really divulge the specifics because of my work on city council.
Right.
It is a slow county, I can tell you that. We are remote right in the center of the county.
Do planes even fly overhead out here?
Yeah, actually, because it's right within a flight pattern.
We're here to talk about off-grid cooking. Do you want to show me what that is?
Sure, set up. Keep in mind, this is a lot of work in progress, so.
Okay.
It is not a refined zone.
That's okay.
But yeah, we have a few different systems as far as off-grid that we can kind of go through. The solar cooker, as you saw, we've got a rocket stove that it's super fun to cook on. It's got a griddle top on it. And then I've got biogas that's...
So is that very similar to the biodigester that we're using to produce electricity with our garden waste and food waste in SLO?
Yep, exactly. Just a much lower tech version. You can see the digester.
Oh, wow.
It's literally the bottom, think of it as the stomach, because it's basically just water and whatever goes into it. And then the top bag is the actual methane.
Wow. So you get horse manure from your neighbor.
Mm-hmm. It's a primer it's basically an inoculant to get the beneficial bacteria growing within the system.
Okay.
Because when you start, it's just that bottom bag is just water. So it doesn't have anything in it. So then you add, and it's got to be fresh manure. So you're basically taking the bacteria from the gut of the horse and then putting it into this system. And then that starts the process. until that's creating actual methane, you can't add the food waste or anything else because there's nothing in there to digest it. You get the bacteria mixes wrong, and then you can start to produce bacteria that creates too much CO2, so then you're not creating methane. So it's kind of a primer scenario. But then once it's making gas, then you can literally put whatever you want into it.
How do you then use it?
It has sandbags around the whole thing, and it literally just uses gravity to push that out. So I've got it plumbed into here, goes underground. That's just to capture if you get any water in the line. It goes to one central point and you can drain it, but then that goes up into the earth.
Okay, and that's kind of like the belchings of the
that yeah, bucket. Yeah, so anytime that you bucket. Add material, then it spills out. You can basically create a whole kind of a leach field, which then will go underground and you can feed your plants directly, or you can take that, water it down, and then feed your plants with it. As long as you don't have human manure in there, you can put that on plants directly. If you add human manure to the scenario, then you have to go through a whole leach line system so that you can actually, you know, strain it correctly.
So you don't kill yourself?
Yeah.
We spent millennia trying to figure out how not to kill ourselves.
And it's questionable whether or not we've done a very good job of that.
We haven't done a very good job of it, as this last 18 months has shown. That's the methane source.
Yep.
Okay.
That's for that cooker. Here is the solar cooker.
Cool.
Obviously, you can make these things as well fairly easily. This is a particular version. What I like about this one is even if at night, I can plug this into a DC source. So since we're all off-grid, I've got battery systems where I can literally just plug this in like a DC outlet and use the battery, and I can still cook with it at night if I wanted to.
So there's a lot of shiny metal.
Yep. So the cylinder is where it's being cooked in the center. That's where you do the cooking.
So you pull the cylinder out, and that's where you put your food in there?
Yep.
What kind of food works and what kind of food doesn't?
So far, you can do just about anything that you would do inside of a normal oven. It's just how you do it is a little bit different. In the sense of there's no way that you can, you know, just put a thermometer on it and check it every 20 minutes or so. So you have to pull it out. But we've done pies in it. You can do bread in it. You have to accommodate for it being a very small cylinder. So if it expands and hits the top of it, then you're doing a lot of cleaning.
It's probably great for baguettes.
Yes.
Baguette-shaped bread.
Yes. Exactly. Certain things are just take longer. When I do rice, I just do it on the stovetop, and then you can reheat it in this. If you're doing rice, then you can only be doing rice versus if, say, you wanted to do like a stir fry or a mix or something. Then you can put the pre-cooked rice in with all the veggies at the same time, and then it's all done at one time versus doing multiple layers, which would then take you hours because it takes about 20 to 50 minutes to do a meal in it.
So patience is a virtue.
Patience is a virtue.
So kind of the opposite of a microwave.
Yes. I mean, the thing heats up to, I think, 500 degrees. So it's okay. Not that it doesn't have the heat to do it. It's just the process of doing it. Then the rocket stove.
Is it this little thing that's the stove?
Yep.
Oh, okay. That makes a little bit more sense.
So it's a griddle top. With these things, you can literally... You could cook anything on it. You put whatever you want on top of the actual stovepipe. Use this so that it can still vent, obviously, but then this sits on top of that, and then you toss over whatever you want.
Oh, wow.
For like pan heating and stuff like that. Like why rocket stoves are beneficial. So we already know that wood is carbon neutral.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio, and I'm Father Ian, playing with food on Issues and Ideas. I'm exploring different ways to cook off the grid with Aaron Gomez, and he just claimed that burning wood is carbon neutral. So is burning wood carbon neutral? I looked into this, and there is a push to make that true. The European Union and the United Kingdom have declared burning wood as carbon neutral in efforts to help meet their emissions targets. The US EPA, under the previous administration, made a move to do a similar thing. However, the current EPA administrator does not agree. What's the issue? Trees store carbon dioxide. They need it, like humans need oxygen. When a tree is cut down, it no longer stores that CO2. When it is burned, it produces CO2 and other gases. So what's going on with Aaron's rocket stove?
So we already know that wood is carbon neutral. This is a more efficient way to burn wood. Now you're creating a greater efficiency for creating heat from that wood, because all this uses is kindling. But because of the J-tube style of how it pulls in air, it just burns the wood at a higher heat.
So then you're using less of it to cook whatever you want to. Versus a big barbecue, there's no airflow coming in. You're literally just using the wood itself.
Efficiency, that's the key for Aaron's rocket stove. And in a conversation about this very subject with Minnesota Public Radio back in 2019, University of Minnesota Professor Emeritus Jim Boyer said that if someone's living in a rural area and they have a stand of trees on their land or close by and available, there's no environmental reason not to use that wood as a source of energy. And that's the situation that Aaron is living in.
When you want to use this, what are the steps to use this?
That's your burn trap. Literally just start a fire in there, and then you throw a couple pieces of kindling. So this is the size of stuff that I burn. And it can be smaller, it can be bigger. You literally just throw a few pieces of that, and then you close this, and this is where it sucks in air. So then it's pulling in air because of the heat system, and then the heat is obviously coming up the vent. For this, it hits the griddle top, heats the griddle top, and then vents out that way. And there's a million different versions of rocket stoves. This is kind of a camp pre-built model, but you can literally build them out of anything you want. The whole idea is just to have a J. The burn chamber basically comes vertical. It sucks the air in, and then you have a burn chamber here, and then it goes up. But because of that burn chamber, that's what creates the efficiency component.
I noticed that it is outdoors. So do you do all your cooking outdoors?
Except for the methane cooker goes into the yurt. I want to build like a full outdoor kitchen to do all this stuff, because you can imagine out here in the middle of summer, cooking inside the yurt just heats up the yurt.
Yeah, I was wondering what the temperature was going to be today.
Yeah. Fortunately, you did not come out on the last heat wave we just had.
Yeah.
Then it's quite a bit hotter. But as you can tell, it's still pretty warm in the sun.
Can we see the methane stove?
Yeah.
Oh, so that's just a basic...
Yeah, it's a normal... And you can convert normal propane to use biogas.
That's just really basic. It's just, it's a basic stove, just using a different, a different fuel.
Yep.
It's not as high tech as I thought it was going to be.
No, it's the polar opposite of high tech. It is low tech.
It was really funny because I was telling somebody, like, I'm going to do all this off-grid cooking, and he's got a cooker that runs off methane gas coming off of biofuel. And I'm like, I can hardly wait to see that. That's so cool. Yeah. And it's a camp stove.
Yeah, quite literally. You can get a two burner if you want. Yeah.
Okay. You have an unlimited supply of sun and wood. How much of a supply do you have of the biogas?
So with this system that I currently have, they say you can cook 2 hours per day.
Okay. And how much maintenance does it require?
Zero. Other than you got to obviously feed it.
That's what I meant. How much maintenance in terms of feeding it? Yeah.
Oh, I mean, maybe, you know, it takes all of 10 minutes in the sense of now that it's up and running, once you get it started. To get it started, you're adding manure almost every day. So then you have to have a source of fresh manure because you can't use anything that's over 2 days old. It doesn't have the right bacteria in it. It goes from anaerobic to aerobic. So, I mean, that's kind of getting it going, and then doing the piping and everything is the upstart. But considering the infrastructure that you would need for normal gas, it is nothing in comparison to that. And then as far as upkeep, you literally just go out there, whatever food waste you have for the day, you literally just pour it in one end and close it.
Could you use the dry leaves and things that are around you?
They don't recommend doing dry leaves because of the digestion system. You're basically adding a more difficult fuel to digest. And since this isn't a system where you can get any of the material that doesn't get digested out, you want to kind of stick to wet, what they call wet food.
And you have enough food waste to keep it going to cook 2 hours a day.
Yeah, between that and then, like I said, with the neighbor having manure, you can always add just manure if you wanted to, if you're not doing a bunch of cooking or you're not ending up with a lot of green waste. Because we also do composting on the facility. So I've got worm composting out here. We've got three other compost systems across the way. We use food waste for those as well. It's more just using whatever extra food waste I have and I'm not putting in those systems, I'll throw in this.
Are you also growing your own food?
Yes. That's our long-term goal, is to be fairly self-sufficient when it comes to food production. And then long-term would be to produce enough food to not just feed us, but feed everybody else. We have got plans for this property to have four different agroforests on it. So it'd be dry farmed kind of fruit trees. And then we've got a main crop garden that we just finished that we found feeds the rabbits really well. And the golfers have found that they enjoy it as well.
You should reconsider eating meat.
Yeah. Well, my brother eats meat, so it's going to be up to him to be the rabbit hunter. Yeah, so we've got that going. I have a little experimental garden out front of the yurt that I pull stuff from. The squash is doing really well. So.
we're at the phase of we're trying to experiment and see, you know, I've only done backyard gardening in St. Louis. Super easy place to grow. You can grow just about anything. Never had to deal with any wildlife taking more than a few strawberries here and there. So coming out here and growing, it's literally the polar opposite. Soil is really difficult to grow in. We have to do a ton of soil rehab. You've got wildlife that'll eat just about anything. You've got gophers that we never had to deal with in SLO. I'm trying to figure out the systems first before I have this big goal of like, all right, now I'm going to start putting a ton of time and effort into food production before doing all the experimenting to see, all right, what grows easily or what grows naturally with the soil before rehab, what's going to take a lot of rehab, and then what fits into that cycle as far as food production.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio, and I'm Father Ian, playing with food on Issues and Ideas. Aaron Gomez is demonstrating how to cook carbon-free.
What's your overall motivation or ethos behind this? Could you be considered a prepper?
No, it's not about self-sustaining to remove myself from the world in like some great epidemic that I want to be the only survivor left. It's about reducing your footprint. Something that I learned a lot in the time that I spent on council, and then you know, being very environmentally driven, you start to look at all the data points. I, you know, attended tens of conferences. It's interesting to me that during the entire time on council, we never really talked as a council or as city staff or anybody else about soil health. The number one issue that we deal with from a sustainability standpoint is healthy soils, which then also they're doing tons of experiments on carbon sequestration as it goes into healthy soils. So my motivation here is like, how do you reduce your footprint when daily life is reliant on systems that are inherently unsustainable, on a food system that is inherently unsustainable, and just the constant consumption that is unsustainable? So it's like, it looks maybe like a prepper style, but it's literally about just reducing your impact, because all the things that we purchase have an impact. And the further they are away being produced, the bigger the impact is. We can't stand on our pedestal of calling ourselves environmentalists while purchasing all these goods or supporting a food system that is degrading our topsoil. Something that was eye-opening to me, we have, give or take, 55 years of topsoil left at the current rate that we are losing topsoil because of various things, but especially our food system. That should freak people out. So the more systems we can create like this that are smaller, that reduce that impact, that don't make us reliant on these gigantic farms that aren't really concerned about soil health, I think the better overall we are as a species and the planet for that matter. And it's inherently just unsustainable. I mean, you think the common number is that 40% of our food goes to waste. Not only are we producing something at an unsustainable pace, the majority of it is just going to waste. So why are we putting all this time and effort? And, you know, this idea that, all right, faster production, bigger machinery, more reliance on inputs, when we're creating stuff that will just end up in a landfill to create methane, which we're all trying to get away from, so you got to try and figure out how to capture it. We've created so much complexity, and this is my version of like, all right, how do I personally create simplicity into where I have enough, but I'm not continually just adding to that cycle? Our way of life, just how we live, is unsustainable. But we take it as normal, and we even promote it throughout the world. Like, oh, everybody should live this way. We don't have an ecosystem that can support everybody living this way. So we either need to bring our idea of what life should be down with a lower impact lifestyle, or we have to stop pretending like it's okay and nobody else is paying this cost, because the rest of the world is paying this cost in a very different lifestyle.
Well, you're living the way people were living when the white people first got to California. Have you consulted with any of the American Indian, Native American tribes who still know how to work this particular land?
I have not. No, I can't say that I really have an in to that process.
Because if more people across the country mm-hmm. could move to this type of living, the people who knew how to do that in the different parts, like I said, you know, it's very easy. It's much easier to do here in San Luis Obispo County than in Michigan in December and January, right? But the native people in Michigan did know and did for millennia live in that area and know how to sustain themselves through the seasons.
Yeah. I would somewhat argue that this idea that it's easier in California, I think it's easier because of our very modernized system of how we truck water around, which that in itself is unsustainable. When we look at this property, why we want to dry farm so much of it is we don't have the water to sustain doing this mass agriculture. So we're sucking all these areas dry. It creates a nice environment to grow things. But as soon as you remove that water component, it changes this landscape significantly. And to your point, I think Native Americans would have a much better idea of how do you actually farm something in a historically sustainable fashion that we've gotten so far away from.
Climate change is real, and we all have to do our part. But it's more than just what Aaron demonstrated. I recently discovered that the concept of an individual person's carbon footprint, while coined in the 1990s, was thrown into the common lexicon by the oil giant BP in a 2005 ad campaign. The successful intent was to get the general public to focus on their own carbon footprint and divert attention away from the impact of the fossil fuel industry on climate change. Yes, together we can achieve a lot as individuals, but don't be fooled. We cannot offset the powerful polluting of global industries. Aaron is doing his small part to reduce his contribution to a warming planet. Perhaps he's inspired you to make some changes. He also showed me new ways to geek out when playing with food. This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
We're going to take a short break. When we return, the San Luis Obispo Chamber's Jim D'Antona will speak with photographer and activist Renata Campbell. And with wildfires come lawyers, previous survivors have warnings. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Mary Louise Kelly. NPR got its start 50 years ago, with all things considered. Since then, we have grown a lot.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington.
Well, it's happened again. You've wasted another perfectly good hour listening to Car Talk.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
This is Here and Now.
Welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
You're listening to Planet Money from NPR.
I'm Anoush Zamarodi, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour.
This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington.
You're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Sam Sanders.
You're listening to Throughline.
From our first show to new ones this year and programs you'll hear in the future, NPR never stops growing. One thing that hasn't changed, our relationship with you. For half a century, listeners like you have made everything you hear from NPR possible. Support us now and for the next 50 years by giving to this station. Here's how.
Welcome back to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Carol Tangeman, and now, Working Lunch.
Welcome to Working Lunch, the Chamber's weekly series where we talk with community leaders, getting to know the person behind the work and the interesting things they are working on. I'm Jim D'Antona, CEO of the San Luis Chamber, and today we'll be having a conversation with photographer and activist Renata Campbell. Renata is a wedding photographer based out of San Luis Obispo, owner of Renata Campbell Events and Photography. She's a storyteller who strives to bring diverse narratives to life through photojournalism. Campbell is passionate about portraying the love between all couples, displaying their respect for one another in portraits, and specifically works with the LGBTQ plus couples, BIPOC couples, and couples who believe in being part of an inclusive community. A longtime Central Coast resident, Campbell has years of experience working for both Cal Poly and Cuesta College. She holds a bachelor's degree in communication arts from Loyola Marymount University and a master's degree in education from Cal Poly. I'm so looking forward to talking with Renata about what led to her activism in social justice work and what it's like being an inclusive photographer and how the events industry has morphed over the last year. Renata, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I always like to start by learning a little bit more about how people came to be in SLO. Were you born and raised here, or did you find SLO by some other circuitous path?
I am originally from Los Angeles, and all of my family, my immediate family, are from LA. My husband lived in Monterey once his parents returned from England. His father was in the military. And Chris always wanted to move back to a small town. And so I thought, you know, a suburb of LA would be fine with me, but he actually really meant small. So I figured working in the music industry, we would live in Santa Barbara and I would commute that way. But unfortunately, from a housing perspective, that didn't work out. And we moved to San Luis Obispo.
When you were in Los Angeles, you said a little bit about, you know, being in the music industry. What were you doing down there?
For 15 years prior to moving to San Luis Obispo, I worked at Warner Brothers Records for 4 years. Was really into the working with new wave artists, if you know who new wave artists are. And then I started working at a music management company in which we represented the B-52s, Brian Ferry, OMD, Seal, a lot of the more new age groups, as well as Counting Crows, who some of you may know.
Have we gotten to that part of our life where you have to explain what new wave was?
People don't know. People don't know what new wave is. So the B-52s, Love Shack Baby, that might be a band that you know. So
that was our era. So I get that. So it sounds like you were steeped in the arts down there and now here. Do you come from a creative family or are you an outlier?
No, my parents were definitely creative. My father was also a photographer, so he always had a camera around his neck, even though he never charged. He just took pictures of everyone and gave them everything. And my mom was an amazing cook and baker. So unfortunately, I'm a terrible cook because she always cooked for me. But and I have an older sister that is a well-known artist in the LA area for quilting as well as mixed media.
I would assume back when you moved here, there obviously wasn't really a lot of remote work like we have now. And that line of work that you were in was not prevalent here in SLO. Is that the case?
Correct. I really had to reinvent myself coming here. Unfortunately, my supervisors, who were absolutely amazing, said that if you can't stay in Los Angeles, you can't have this work with us anymore. The artists that I would have represented lived all around the United States and Canada, but they wanted the hub to be in Los Angeles. So I had to reinvent myself.
March 2020, everybody thought the idea was you had to be in the place where you were going to do your work.
Right.
There wasn't this other option. In your previous work, you must have, though, had to go other places to do all your work, right?
Actually, I traveled 85,000 air flight miles a year. Being on tour, visiting clients, organizing their schedules, their writing times, meeting with other bands that wanted to collaborate. REM was really big at the time with the B-52. So when Kate Pearson had to do Shiny Happy People, working through that, being on various shows, you know, The Tonight Show. So organizing all that. And it was a lot. But it was so fun.
It's like we need to do a whole program just on your previous music career. That's so fun. You obviously had to adjust your professional life once you got here. What was that next step for you in trying to reinvent yourself?
Well, my husband was really funny because he had already received his LMFT license. And he said, you know what? You have been counseling bands for 15 years. You should just go get a counseling degree. And being that stubborn person, it's like, don't tell me what to do. I will do whatever. And guess what I did? I went to Cal Poly and I got a master's in counseling. So it was absolutely what I needed. And it fit well within the next step of my career.
Well, and looking at that, how long did it take to kind of find that once you got here? Was that something you did right away or were you still trying to find that, what was going to be that next step?
Oh no, it definitely took me a while. I received my degree in 2005, so 7 years, before I did that, because I really, and I also had young children. So it was a matter of trying to work within their schedules, work within his schedule, and then my job. And so from 2003 to 2005 is when I earned my master's degree.
It's not an uncommon story for people with a diverse background, you know, giving up on SLO and going back to or moving out of the area because there just isn't that connection. What kept you in the community?
I have to be honest, if I wasn't married and had children, I definitely would have moved back to Los Angeles and continued that music career. But because my husband liked the area so much and the kids were starting to really adapt and have friends and to really become incorporated into the city is what made me stay. So I unfortunately was a little miserable for a while, but now I can't see myself being any... I mean, I'd love to visit Los Angeles, but I don't really consider it home anymore.
So once you got the counseling degree, where did that lead you? What was the next step for you in utilizing that degree?
Well, I always wanted to work in higher education. And so working at Cal Poly, one of the prerequisites is, or one of the preferred prerequisites is having a master's degree. And with the positions that I wanted at Cuesta, you also needed to have that master's degree. I did work at Cuesta before I got the master's in the math department as a division assistant, but I wanted to do more academic advising and working with students in that way. So it did require a postgraduate degree.
So besides being a student at Cal Poly, did you end up working, get a job there at Cal Poly?
I did. So I interned at Cal Poly during my graduate work. And then student affairs really just grabbed me. And so I started interning in the student affairs department in what is now called the Dean of Students Office. It was called Student Life and Leadership at the time. And I was able to work in the Multicultural Center and in Greek Life with Greek Life students as an intern. And then there was an open position in the Multicultural Center, and I became the coordinator of multicultural programs, attempting to bring diversity programs to the student body.
And did you start out with that idea from that counseling spot as a way to work on and focus on your work on diversity? Or was that, you know, through the lived experience that you saw that this was something that was missing, or both?
I definitely saw that there was something missing here in San Luis Obispo. When you look at and you see that the population of African Americans is 1-2%, and the same for Cal Poly, I wanted to attempt to bring sense of belonging to the community. And I mean, it's a lot better now than it was in 1998 when I started, or no, I started in 2006, sorry, in 2006. But having, you know, how are students finding their communities? And working in the Multicultural Center definitely gave me that option to offer students different options. And a lot of students actually were going home. They were driving 2 to 3 hours to go home to visit family and friends. And then with the Multicultural Center, we tried to be that family, be that support, so that they didn't have to go home as often. Their grades improved, you know, and they felt that they had more of a community here, as well as going to whatever their original locations were.
Well, that must have been pretty special in terms of making connections with those who probably had, like, didn't feel connected, and really building relationships. Was that a part of what you were doing there?
Definitely. And the African-American community at Cal Poly was just so small. And so working along with the other, students of color, it just really created a great opportunity to get to know other students, learn from other students. And then that also brought in some of the other clubs and organizations and the Caucasian students as well. So it really became a family.
Most people know you as the photographer, but obviously some of your past work there. But before we got to that, I wanted to talk about your work. You talked about Cuesta College, mm-hmm. And you do work at the California Men's Colony. Is that correct? How'd that come to be?
That is correct. Unfortunately, I decided to go full time as a photographer in November of 2019. So, and with COVID coming about, it was not quite successful for me to do that. So I really felt that I needed to find something so that I could generate income for my family. And so I resorted back to higher education. Cuesta luckily had a part-time advisor position available I didn't know where. Cuesta has four sites. So they have the San Luis Obispo campus, the Paso Robles campus, the South County campus, and I didn't know, CMC. So in the interview, they asked if there was a particular site that you were more interested in or did not want to participate. And there was one that I said that I didn't want to. I ended up getting CMC, which made me so happy because that was one of my choices. And so working with these men of color, most of them are men of color, it just continued my work working in diversity initiatives. And it also strengthened the advocacy for incarcerated students.
Well, I wonder if you'd be able to share some of the issues you're tackling with the inmates to kind of prepare them for life after CMC.
Well, one of the most difficult things right now is there is no online presence at CMC. So when you think of everything outside of prison, you know, you have to do online forms, your emails, you're on Zooms, you're on all these things. Men that have been in prison for 10 to 15 years have no idea and don't understand the concepts of what these are. So that's the biggest issue that I see is technology and having them understand that. One of the questions that I received was, how do I know that the internet won't take my information and use it for bad? You know, and it's true. I mean, if you haven't worked with this for 15, you know, in this particular arena for 15 years, you could be very skeptical. And so having them become familiar with online classes to continue their education, et cetera, has really been a challenge. So one of the things that I would like to see is like a small workshop on, you know, what to do or what to expect when you get out. And that is not something that no one is doing right now, at least in San Luis Obispo, but that would be something that I would like to see so that they are, you know, that they can continue to be successful in their educational prospects.
These people come out mm-hmm. and if they're not prepared and the recidivism rate has to grow, so, you know, hopefully you're seeing some success with those things.
The faculty and the CMC staff that have worked with me have really been amazing. I mean, to see, I can tell you that the grade point averages of these men are very, very high. They're really bright. And once they start doing the educational components, they love it and they want to continue with it. And I think that's really important.
Sure, community colleges around the state.
Mm-hmm. All of them actually try to work. Even Ellen Hancock works with the federal prison.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. The Slow Chamber's Jim D'Antona is speaking with photographer and activist Renata Campbell.
I'm going to jump to something a little bit off from there. Is it true that you were in the famous or infamous, to residents of Slow, Oprah Winfrey Happiest City in America video?
I was. Oh my gosh, that was 10 years ago. I can't believe it was that long ago. But Michael Gunther and I are alums of a Loyola Marymount University. And I think I don't know if he pitched it to Oprah or who pitched it, but Michael Gunther recommended me as one of the, or I should say referred me as one of the people that the Oprah production company should speak with about San Luis Obispo because I was working in diversity initiatives. Unfortunately, it didn't really go much into that. It was more about my family. Beth Marino, myself, and Michael Gunther were those locals who were able to talk about San Luis Obispo.
It's so funny. I got a chance after.
Did you see it? Did you watch it?
I did watch it. It was so fun. And again, yes, it was interesting to hear from, I think they were trying to get the locals who weren't born and raised here from the other perspective. Great choice, because even here we are 10 years later and your story's still holding and you get to be forever in that the Oprah Winfrey video.
Yes, that's one of my two truths and a lie. I can honestly say I was on the last season of Oprah Winfrey. So
that's amazing. So going into your photography background, we heard that you got your start in sports photography. Is that mm-hmm. correct?
My parents were huge sports fanatics. And so they, you know, living in Los Angeles, I was always at a Dodger game, even though I wasn't that big of a baseball fan, but I loved the energy, surrounded by the energy. And my parents were huge Laker supporters. So when I came here, my daughters were very involved in sports. One was in cheerleading and tumbling. So it's not just the traditional rah-rah. It was one that does six, you know, back handsprings. And trying to capture that was always a challenge. And then my other daughter was in basketball. But one thing I noticed in San Luis Obispo is there were always sports photographers at the male games, none at the female games. So I thought, you know what, I want to be that photographer for the ladies. And I submitted my photos for yearbooks so that, you know, they had those images, not just parent images or images from the yearbook editor. And so that got me started doing that. And I still love it. But I don't know if you remember, in 2019, right before COVID, there was a US qualifier for the pentathlon multisport. So it's swimming, fencing, equestrian, laser, and run. And I was asked to photograph the female component of the multisport. And just FYI, KSBY covered the male, not the female sections.
The photography and obviously now even the coverage is so disturbing, especially when we have such amazing women athletes. You look at the women's national soccer team, you know those things are happening at all different sport levels.
And the young lady that did go to the Olympics, I think there was a lot of press who was a fencer here in the community. She was actually one of the ones at the pentathlon.
Was that a impetus from that sports kind of doing some of that to wedding, or was wedding always on the list to eventually get to?
No, actually, I had a friend of mine ask me to photograph their wedding, and I thought, no, I am not doing weddings. I will never do weddings. I won't deal with bridezillas. I don't, la, 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 la. But when I actually attended the wedding as a photographer, and I saw the love between the couple, between the family, and the friends for that couple, I was hooked. I was hooked. There's so much negativity in the world right now. And to see people come together for something so positive and so good. I am a positive person and I just love being around positive energy and being at a wedding. It just, everyone's just so happy and so proud of the couple committing themselves to one another. So I'm hooked now.
You know, when you look at your website and thinking about your business, you have such inclusive messaging, really celebrating it. Do you think couples find you because you are so open and upfront with that?
I do. And I've actually asked couples that very question because I don't think I'm, you know, insofar as an SEO perspective, I'm, you know, not on page one or anything like that yet. But they have stated that because of the written text that I write, as well as the images, it reinforces that I am one who is an advocate. There are a lot of photographers out there that are advocates, but not showing LGBTQ or couples of color in any of their galleries or in their messaging. It makes people think, okay, maybe they're not as serious as we thought they were, and they'll go on to the next photographer.
Well, and we've seen such major impacts to the wedding industry these past 18 months. Are we seeing things return to normal, or how's it different today?
Well, right now, vendors feel like they're drinking out of a fire hose. It is really crazy. I actually have a wedding in October on a Monday because this particular venue was so busy. So it is just extremely busy, and vendors want to accommodate every couple that wants to get married. So because their salaries and their fees were non-existent in 2020, people are taking on as much as they possibly can. So I'm concerned about burnout with the vendors because they are trying to do that and make up as much money as they can to recoup their losses. But that would be the biggest thing that I would be concerned about. I think it is going to come back and level off and be normal again. Just right now, it's absolutely bonkers. But yeah, that's okay. That's okay. We're like, we need to make money. We have to, you know, we have to support our family. So we'll do it.
Well, and I would just imagine right now what we're seeing is that dam releasing all that water that was held for 18 months. Plus, yes. Now you have people who are in their normal time frame are going to do that. So you're doubling up all this. And I guess the vendors are taking everything they can get for that same, huh?
Correct. There's, I think there's one vendor that normally does, I think, 40 weddings a year. And I think this year she's doing 73. So yeah, it's a lot, but we want people to be married. We want people to be happy and start their lives. And, you know, this is our way of bringing that to them.
We all had trials and tribulations through COVID, but watching the couples who were planning to get married and celebrate those things put off, definitely feels nice to see it come back. As you look back, are there any silver linings from the past 18 months that you hope to make permanent in your work or life?
Yes, definitely. I am a huge supporter of intimate weddings. So weddings that are less than 75, so that you are having the core people that love you there, and you know, and all the rest, it's nice to send them announcements, but the intimate weddings versus the larger weddings, I really prefer the intimate weddings. Another thing that I see is live streaming. So people have realized that because, you know, not everyone's going to be there. So live streaming is definitely something that I see that's definitely going to stay, especially for, you know, those older individuals that aren't able to fly to a particular place. Another thing is seeing more LGBTQ and BIPOC couples of color represented in more traditional magazines and not just the traditional bride, and couples really caring about the experience. So if there is a destination that they want to get married, going to that destination and live streaming, like I said, I'm actually going to be photographing a couple that are in Houston right now. So they'll be flying in as a destination wedding to San Luis Obispo, but I believe they could potentially be live streaming so that their friends in Houston who aren't able to make it could enjoy their happiness.
Has Slow seen, in your opinion, an uptick in some of those inclusive weddings and looking for the LGBTQ plus and BIPOC communities coming to this area?
I haven't really seen that many couples of color per se, but the LGBTQ community definitely spiked up, which makes me really happy. And to be able to see on Instagram and Facebook other photographers that are photographing LGBTQ couples as well has really been inspiring to me. We just need to make sure that those voices get out there.
Yeah, and I think the more that we have these, that the more welcoming, again, our community can be and celebrating all of these pieces. So as you look to the future of your work, we talked about streaming options. Are there technical changes in how photography is done, how it's shared? I know when I got married, I have a big photo book, like album. Like, do they do that anymore? Or is everything shared digitally?
Oh my goodness, yes. The biggest thing that photographers want you to do is to have the albums, because a lot of time media changes. So you had Beta, you had VHS, you had DVDs, and those are all gone now, but your album that you have is still with you, and it still, you know, brings back those memories. So yes, photographers definitely encourage couples to get those books. The biggest thing that I see is technology. So videography, especially with TikTok, Instagram Reels, you know, all that, people are asking for more video now, especially drones. Drones are huge.
Well, Renata, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate you sharing your story.
Thank you, everyone.
That was the Slow Chambers, Jim D'Antona, speaking with photographer and activist Renata Campbell. As fires ravage Northern California, lawyers have descended on the region in a bid to sign up victims as clients. The emerging wildfire litigation industry has become big business for attorneys in recent years. KQED's Lily Jamali has more.
Ash falls from the sky as Sandy Sullins finishes up a plate of barbecue chicken with her family and other evacuees at a park near the Plumas County Courthouse here in the northeastern corner of the state. They're still reeling from the loss of their home of 51 years to the Dixie Fire. The fire has burned almost 1 million acres, making it the biggest in California history.
Well, we want to hear what's being done or who started the fires. You know, because you don't know. You only hear. And it's the same story over and over and over again. PG&E or...
Days after the Dixie Fire broke out, the utility PG&E indicated to state regulators that its equipment may have played a role in sparking the blaze. The air is thick with smoke, both from the fire and from the barbecue, which is free. It's been organized by a group of lawyers. One is local, Brett Cook has been the Sullins' lawyer for many years.
We're just providing some food for the people that were evacuated from the Dixie Fire. This is a way of giving back to the community, and it was simply a way to, to make people put a little smile on their face.
Cook has teamed up with the law group Potter Handy, based hundreds of miles south of here in San Diego, and some of those lawyers have flown up for the event. But not far from the brisket and butterhorn rolls, there's a stack of papers, contracts, to sign up with the firm in exchange for 25% of any reward. This is hardly the only firm on the prowl.
We know the destruction of wildfires all too well. When utility companies neglect maintenance and safety, homes and lives can be lost.
At least two dozen firms are making the rounds, many with the promise of suing PG&E. The utility's equipment has sparked catastrophic wildfires nearly every year since 2015.
Thousands of survivors' research brought them to the Watts Guerra Law Firm.
This ad is for a law group headed by Michael Watts, an attorney based in Texas who traveled to the fire zone to hold a town hall meeting at a public library. It featured famed consumer advocate Erin Brockovich, who joined by Zoom. She's been a paid spokesperson for the group. Watts boasts of his role in negotiating a settlement for 70,000 victims of fires caused by PG&E from 2015 to 2018. That deal promised fire victims $13.5 billion. But the deal isn't actually worth that, and never has been. In a highly unusual outcome, half of it was funded as stock of PG&E, which remains depressed as PG&E is implicated in more fires. The head of a special trust set up to distribute their money told us the fire victims will never be made whole. Victoria Gann saw an ad for Watts' town hall on Facebook. She lost her home in Paradise in the 2018 campfire and is still living in a trailer.
Oh, God, it made me sick and it made me mad. You know, like it's right on the heels of it. Like, you know, give these people a break.
Gann is one of a number of fire survivors from the past who've been mobilizing to try to educate those now going through the harrowing experience they know all too well.
It's kind of like a dog and pony show, you know, that he puts on out there. He puts on the act of the good guy.
Watts declined to be interviewed, but in an email, he said the deal was one he was, quote, very proud to have worked on with fine lawyers across California to achieve on behalf of all our clients. David Hollister, the district attorney in Plumas County, has some advice for victims of the Dixie Fire.
This is a big, big life-changing decision that you're going to make. So we want you to take a step back, take a deep breath, get all the information you can, and then make a really good choice that's going to protect yourself going forward.
Hollister says the last thing he wants is for people who just lost everything to be victimized twice. I'm Lily Jamali.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.